This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. Our guests this week: screenwriter and director William Nicholson, and Halifax's finest indie disco merchants, the Orioles. William Nicholson is a screenwriter, novelist, and director. He has screenwriting credits on films such as Gladiator, Les Mis, Elizabeth the Golden Age, Breathe, Everest, Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, Shadowlands, First Night, and more. He wrote and directed his recent, deeply personal movie, Hope Gap, which got a UK release in 2020. The movie is a semi-autobiographical work inspired by his own parents' divorce and reworked from his 1989 play, The Retreat from Moscow. It's a powerful movie. It really grabbed me by the throat. There are moments where you almost want to leave the room. And it does a good job of making you feel sympathy for all the parties, regardless of your moral stance on the character's actions. You still feel sad for everyone. It's a thought-provoking, beautiful piece of work, and I hope you find this interview fascinating. We talk about various films in his back catalogue, some of which I haven't seen, but learning about the process of screenwriting is really interesting, I think. Hope Gap stars Bill Nighy and Annette Bening and is out now on Netflix in the UK, Certificate 12A, I think due to a single use of strong language.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Isn't that amazing?
Well, you're punctual.
I am. That's how I am.
How are you?
Always on time. I'm very well, thanks.
So I really loved Hope Gap, which is, it's a weird thing to say for something that made me so sad. But I was bowled over by how powerful it was. It really hit me. And it's not an experience I've been through. My parents are super...
I was going to ask.
No, yeah. My parents are super close. And that's really informed... I guess that's really informed my view of marriage as well. And, you know, my wife and I are fortunate to be, you know, we're sort of best friends. And maybe that made it more powerful. I don't know. But it's a testament to how real... it felt, you know, and how much empathy there was in the film. I wondered, so I've got lots of things to ask about it, but firstly, I wondered, what did you learn about yourself from making the film?
So it's about me and my parents.
Yeah.
It's very biographical. From a long time ago, obviously, all these events happened when I was 26, 27. It's taken me from then till now to do the learning. I'm still learning, actually. A lot of stuff, your parents are so, they're like your first models of what a man is and what a woman is.
Yeah.
You know, they're so important. And that forms your thinking for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So the way they are to you, to me, and the way they are to each other forms my thinking about what a marriage is, what love is, what parents are, what relationships are. And when you gradually realize, as I did when I was young, that it wasn't a good marriage. And I knew it from when I was about 13. I remember watching them, my mother, you know, attacking my father and saying, don't do that, you know, he'll go away. I mean, he didn't for a long time, but he did eventually. So, I've had a long time to process it, and I learned the original lessons very quickly, but there are deeper lessons that you don't learn quickly. And I mean, the original lessons I learned were about being honest, being the person you really are with your partner instead of presenting the kind of person you think they want you to be, you know?
Yeah.
Because that was what my father was doing. He was trying to be the person that my mother wanted him to be, and he couldn't do it. And being honest, if you're, you know, things are going bad for you, you've got to give some warning, if you like, some indication of what's happening. You can't just bottle it up and go on being nice and then one day walk out, which is what my father did. That's cruel. And although I blame my mother for the way she treated him, and I blame my father for the way he behaved, but in the end, I don't blame either of them. I mean, they did their best. They got into a relationship they shouldn't have got into, I now think. So I learned all of those lessons, and I've behaved accordingly in my own marriage, by which I mean I've avoided the same mistakes. And I have a very happy, long marriage now. But the things that, you know, when I was working on the film, it all kind of comes back. And I realize all sorts of things in me, guilt, anger, those kind of feelings, feeling of responsibility, feeling like, not that it was my fault, but that somehow I should have made it all right.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. All of those strange feelings. And they're not going to go away, even though both my parents are now dead.
It's so interesting, that idea of putting up a front and who we are really, and when are you being real with someone and when are you not? I mean, now we're talking and I feel like I'm being fairly real with you, but we don't know each other, and there's a, you know, you're being recorded for a podcast, which is probably making you slightly more guarded. And but then how far do you take that as well? And, you know, my wife said to me that she feels like a chameleon sometimes, that she will adapt a little bit to whoever she's with. And I think that's natural to a degree. And then also, we had this conversation about, well, if what would you be doing now if I wasn't here? Just in terms of the activity, you know, would you be watching this same film? Or would you be doing something different? And so if you would be doing something different, to a degree, you've does that mean you're not really being you? Which I don't think is true, because I think no one would have a personality if we just existed in a vacuum. It's experiences and learning to interact with people that makes us develop, and that becomes who we are, and that's valid. But where the line is really difficult to work out, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure you need to work it out. I think you're right. It is normal, it's natural to be a little bit different with different people. I mean, I'm with my children, I'm a father with my wife, I'm a husband with my friends, I'm a friend with my colleagues, I'm a colleague. And each person is slightly different, and I behave slightly differently. I feel different obligations and different needs from them, so I'll behave differently. So I think that's okay. I think what you have to try to do all the time is to be honest. And the things that work against honesty are the desire to be admired, you know, we want everybody to think we're something terrific. So we kind of sort of shade the truth all the time in the way we present ourselves. The desire to look as if we're strong, even invulnerable, which is a really dangerous thing, particularly for men, you know. As men, we are culturized to feel like we can handle things. And a lot of the time we actually can't. And what do you do then? And if you made people realize, oh, I'm fine, nothing gets to me, and actually it's getting to you inside, then obviously trouble is coming down the line, and it's all going to explode at some point. Whereas if you can somehow train yourself, and I think it's easier when you're older, I think it's hard when you're young, it's easier when you're older to basically admit weakness, live with weakness, share your weakness, then people know where they are. And I often think of it in terms of rather silly little details, like I'm in the early morning, when I'm an early morning riser, I like to work in the mornings. I don't like to talk at breakfast. I don't want anybody asking me questions at breakfast. You know, I'm doing other things. I'm thinking, now, you know, what can you do about that? You can sort of deal with it by being a bit grumpy or whatever. The simplest thing is just to say to whoever's with having breakfast with you, by the way, before we move in together, you better know about me. Don't talk to me when I wake up until lunchtime. or whatever it is you want to say. And, you know, problem solved. And that's a kind of superficial, tiny version of something you can say about much, much more profound things about yourself. You know, like, by the way, I'm somebody who feels very anxious about my relationship with my mother, you know, or whatever it is. So go easy on me. I mean, just tell these things. And that way, people can handle it. And they can handle you, and you can handle them. And the goal, I think, is to be with each other person the way you are with yourself, rather than the performance version. I don't think it's ever possible to get all that all the way there.
No.
I mean, when you're all by yourself, you're going to pick your nose in a way you won't in front of somebody else. And that's just as well. That's fine. But if you can be the person you are alone, including the person who gets tired and gets grumpy and irritable and so on, with the other person, then it's going to work out. Your relationship's going to work out.
Yeah.
And we don't do that because we're so insecure, we're so fearful. We think, if they knew me as I am by myself, they wouldn't like me anymore. They wouldn't want to be with me.
Yeah.
So I've got to go on saying, I can do this, I can do that, I've achieved at this, I've achieved at that. I mean, it's very wearing, you know, everybody constantly trying to out-achieve each other. So so that, I think that's the goal. And you're never going to get there, but work towards it.
Yeah.
And you get huge rewards. You really do. Because people kind of, they start to relax in your presence. They start to think, oh, this isn't somebody I've got to compete with all the time. You know, that's so restful.
Yeah.
You know, let's just hang out.
What's interesting to me is because the film is kind of based on a play you wrote, Retreat from Moscow,
yeah,
which was about, yeah, was that about 30 years ago you wrote that?
20.
No. So I know there's maybe not a huge difference between being 50 and 70 as well as between being 20 and 40 or something, but I wondered how much it's changed from a play, because sadly I never saw the play, so I've got no sort of frame of reference there. So
yeah,
how much has it changed in those 20 years?
It's changed a certain amount, not totally. I've been able to improve it. I've been able to use the fact that it's a film in all sorts of ways that obviously you can't on stage.
Yeah.
The core story is the same. Some of the dialogue is the same, but I've made the ending much better. I've improved it in a kind of professional way. I those 20 years, I've got better, and I've been able to. Also, I've had more distance from it. So I've been able to think my way through how I could have improved that. The ending of the play was a little bit more melodramatic, and I don't think it was really all that good. So I think I've got a better ending now in the film.
Yeah.
But in other ways, you know, it's funny. It felt to me like a new work that I was working on, partly because as I was writing it, I was walking the location all the time where I shot it and working out how to do it in that place. And that makes a big difference. So the town that it's set in is almost like another character in the movie.
Yeah.
And of course, I couldn't do that on stage.
Did you see the Bill Nighy film Sometimes, Always, Never?
No, I haven't seen it.
Watch it, because... I said to my wife as we was watching Hope Gap that it almost felt like it could be the director's follow-up to Sometimes, Always, Never. Because, well, obviously, Bill Nighy is such a... He's always himself, isn't he, to a degree? You can't take Bill Nighy at Bill Nighy. And so, but then also the director, Carl Hunter, he is... he's quite obsessed with Crosby Beach near Liverpool. And he walks it every... If you look on his Instagram, he takes photographs of it. Like every morning, he walks his same stretch of beach. And so there's this coastal kind of setting that's important to the film. And again, it's very sort of relationship-based. And even there's a slight... Although it was shot digitally, he used old lenses. And so sometimes there's a slight bit of blurring on them, which I noticed was the same with Hope Gap. Sometimes there'd be a slight bit out of focus along the top of the frame. And
that's because of the anamorphic lenses.
Right.
It was Hope Gap was shot on anamorphic, which has that. I love the effect, yeah.
Yeah, it looks great. Yeah, I think you'd find it an interesting...
I will.
...watch. I know you've directed once before, but primarily your work in film has been writing for the screen.
Yeah.
Do you struggle with the amount of attention and credit a director tends to get for movies?
I guess I do, yes. But, you know, it's every film I've worked on, when I've seen what the director does, I'm really impressed. And I think to myself, oh boy, you know, I couldn't have done that.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I don't grudge the credit. I suppose I would say that director and writer should get equal billing.
Yeah.
Because the writer, you know, conceives the whole thing, the characters, the story. Also, as I'm always telling people, when I write a screenplay, when anybody writes a screenplay, it's not the dialogue. They could write a whole movie with no dialogue. The screenplay is the film on paper. I'm writing down what you're going to see. You know, so I'm writing down what the location is, what's happening, who's looking at who, what they're thinking, what they're feeling before they've said a word. All of that's on the page. The director then takes that and enacts it. And so the true author is the writer of it. Now, the ultimate author is the writer-director. They're doing both, obviously. And there are plenty of those, actually. But the director for hire who takes over a script is not the author, in my opinion. They are, and in the old days of Hollywood, everybody understood that. Actually, in the old days of Hollywood, they thought the producer was the author, usually. Producer had the idea. So, yes, I do struggle with it a bit. But on the other hand, you know, it's up to me. If I want to direct, I can direct. I didn't realize that for a long time. For a long time, I thought, oh, it's too difficult. And then it was after I'd done Nell. I did a film called Nell with Jodie Foster. And the studio said, have you ever thought of directing? And I said, I don't think I can. And they said, well, why not? You're a writer. You can tell stories. You know, you get a good cinematographer and a good first and a good editor. They'll carry you. And this is completely true. It doesn't make me a great director, but it means I can direct. And I discovered that. Now, the great directors have a kind of genius, somebody like Ridley Scott. I watched him at work, and he could do things that I could never do in a million years. But, you know, he would be the first to say he needs the script. He needs that story there that he then does his magic on.
Yeah.
So I think at the end of the day, I've come to the conclusion we need each other. But it's true to say that I was very happy to direct my own work and to accept the ownership of it and not have to stand in the background and keep quiet. You know, when I first began a long time ago, BAFTA didn't have awards for writers at all. And three of my scripts got Best Drama of the Year awards way back. Nothing for me, all for the directors. And, you know, now it's all changed, but it was kind of shameful back then.
It's interesting what you say about you can have a whole movie with no dialogue, because, of course, you wrote Les Mis, the movie version.
And yes, although let me just say, that pre-existed me, as you know, and the glory of that is the people who created the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a sort of work on it to turn it into a film, but I very strongly want to give credit to Bublil and Schoenberg and Dave Kretzmer.
Well, this is what I want to understand, as in when you've got, you know, the songs are all there. It's kind of there. So what is involved in being the writer on the movie adaptation of Les Mis? What did you have to do?
Two things. I have to, because of course with a film, you can go beyond the stage.
Yeah.
If you look at the stage version of Les Mis, which is, I think, a triumph, absolutely brilliant piece of work, certainly as created on stage, it's a very clever sleight of hand. It moves from scene to scene sort of with nothing happening, really. I mean, suddenly you're somewhere else because they're singing about something else. Once you're having film, you've got to say, where are we? Are we on a mountain? Are we in a town? Are we in a street? What's happening? How do they get there? And so on. You can't just simply have somebody walk on and start singing something else and the set stays the same. So you've got to place it all, the story. That involves kind of working it out in terms of how to break up the scenes, if you like. So that's part one. Part two, there were several things about the story that they got away with on the stage, but actually were a bit dodgy, particularly to do with the love affair. It was very skimpy, needed more. So it was a matter of adding, not necessarily adding either words or songs, but adding moments so that you actually get who's loving who and why and who's seeing who and all that kind of stuff. But in fact, I did add some scenes and some dialogue, and there was an extra song which we used, which I wrote the kind of what the song should say. That was then turned into a song by the French composers, by Alain Boublil initially. And that then went to Herbie Kretzmer to turn into English, and then it got turned into a song by Schoenberg. So it's a kind of weird roundabout way. But what I'm doing is I'm looking at it and saying, we need to understand what's in this character's head at this point, because we can't just have yet another song. We've got to see him think, what is he thinking? Because this is how film works. If you've created the structure, the emotional structure correctly, if you know that a man is longing to see his daughter or something like that, then a shot of him standing, looking out of a window, looking kind of quiet, you will project onto that what his feelings are. But the film has to allow that. Yeah. And that's quite an important part of film, actually, is the moments on people's faces or the moments where nothing's happening, where the emotion of the story can fill the spaces. So I had to write all of that in. But at the end of the day, it's a kind of almost a technical task.
Yeah.
Because the story pre-exists me, and the structure of the songs pre-exists me. So I don't make any great claims for that. I loved working on it. I was very happy to work with all those talented people. But it's not, I don't claim any credit there.
It's interesting the diversity of your work. And I wondered, when you work on a project like Gladiator, are you working very much outside of yourself in a realm of research and, well, imagination still, obviously, or are you still trying to pull some kind of emotional truth out of yourself?
It's a funny thing. Whatever you write turns into yourself or yeah. comes from yourself. You know, if you were to write a story about giraffes, it would in the end be one of the giraffes would be you and the other giraffe would be your mother or whatever. It's just what happens. So, I'm writing from me. I mean, when I took over that project, I took it over. Well, I was invited to take it over. They were in trouble. And I was invited to take it over because of the pitch that I made when shown the script. And I said, amazing project, but I don't care about this character. And why should I sit and watch somebody who just kills a lot of people?
Yeah.
And they say, what do you think we should do? So I made some suggestions. And all of my suggestions were designed to turn the central character into me. And, what am I? I'm a guy who is, in my opinion, very empathetic. I love my wife very much. I am not interested in killing people. I'm not a general of an army. But on the other hand, I'm a very lovely guy, you know? And so I thought, I've got to make this chap be me.
Yeah.
And along the way, we'll add in that he has great fighting skills and that'll make people love him. But the key thing about why would you love any character? You'd love a character because that character has love in him. That's what makes you love people. So I reconstructed it so that he was somebody who didn't want to be a general, didn't want to be a soldier, wanted to be a farmer, wanted to be with his wife and kid, wanted to get away from it all. And of course, it all goes pear-shaped on him. And from then on, his drive is, of course, to be revenged, but to get back to his wife. But I had this technical problem that his wife is dead, according to plot. So I thought, well, we better have an afterlife, because then he can get back to his wife in the afterlife. So I write all this in. And this is sort of the way I think. So this isn't research. This is coming out of me. I've often said to people as a joke when I give talks, and I say, this made a star out of Russell Crowe. Big, big star. I mean, he was a star before, but a big star. Yeah. And he was. And everybody looks at Russell Crowe in Gladiator and they says he's the perfect man because he's strong, but he's tender. And I say, that's not Russell Crowe. That's me.
But I guess when you're working on, say, Elizabeth, The Golden Age, or even Shadowlands, there is such a degree of history that you're trying to project. Can you give me some idea of the sort of research that goes into a project like that and where you start?
Yes. With Elizabeth, The Golden Age, these are very research-based. But what happens is I read the history and I look for the part of the history that turns me on, because then I can put emotion into it. So I read about Elizabeth, and I realize that here is an anomaly, which is an all-powerful woman. Now, if a woman who is all-powerful gets married back in those times, she loses power because the husband has to be the head of the household.
Yeah,
that's how the kind of thinking was back then, the religious thinking. So she can't marry because she's queen. But she has feelings of wanting to be loved. So what's she going to do about it? And when I looked into what happened, I realized there'd been this point in her life where she had basically loved a man, but realized she couldn't marry him, couldn't even have sex with him in case she got pregnant, because the whole state depends upon all of that. Mm. So what's she going to do with him? So she comes up with the idea that she'll allow him to have a lover who he can have the sex with, but she will be the true love of his life. And this just fascinated me. I thought, what an absolutely brilliant arrangement. And that became the heart of the story that I wanted to tell. I wasn't interested in all the fighting. In fact, I was very against the showing Walter Raleigh jumping around on ships fighting, which he didn't do and wasn't part of the Armada. The Armada was all destroyed by a storm. What I was interested in was the whole idea of a powerful woman also wanting to be vulnerable in the arms of the man she loves, and thinking she can set up a situation with her lady-in-waiting, whereby he can basically have the sex with her, but the love, Elizabeth, and how that gets smashed when the other woman gets pregnant. And that suddenly brings to the fore Elizabeth's own acute sense of, I will never have a child, and how that causes a kind of explosion in her. I thought, what an amazing situation. Now, all of that's historically there, but so there's a lot of other stuff historically there. So it's a process of selecting the bits of history that serve the emotional drama as I perceive it.
Yeah.
And that was what I went for.
Yeah. What are you working on next?
I'm doing something called 13 Lives, which is, the soccer club of Thai boys that got stuck in a cave.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of years. Well, it's them. It's about them. And it's about the cave rescue, which is a great deal more complicated and fascinating than most people realize. And that's in production, actually. Ron Howard is directing it for MGM. And they're shooting that in Australia in a couple of months. So that's underway. And I'm writing a Second World War script called The Big Three, which is about the relationship between Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill during the Second World War, and the way they all bounced off each other and kind of manipulated each other or tried to. So those are the two ones that are actually happening.
Yeah.
And I always have endless other projects.
Yeah. This has been great, mate. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, good talking to you, and all the best with the rest of your lockdown.
Thank you. You too, all right?
Yeah, I do.
Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
Bye, mate. If you're enjoying the show, please follow me on Twitter at Signals Podcast and on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast. If you could leave a nice review or share an episode with a friend, it all helps. Thanks, everyone. The Orioles have just released a new record called La Vita Holistica. It's sort of album number 2.5. Let me explain. The Halifax three-piece released their excellent debut album Silver Dollar Moment in 2018 and followed it up in 2020 with Disco Volador. They decided to rework Disco Volador into a sort of continuous piece of work, adding some new interludes and extended funky outros on some of the songs. It accompanies a new short film of the same name. I caught up with the Orioles from a bedroom somewhere in Manchester to discuss the relationship of different artistic mediums and the benefits of reworking an album after some time has passed. They were good company. I hope you enjoy.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey.
You're all together?
Yeah.
How are you?
Hey, not bad, man, not bad.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Where are you?
At Ez's house.
In a surprisingly sunny Manchester.
Mm.
Nice, it's nice here as well. I'm down in Southend.
Oh, nice.
Do you all live in Manchester, or are you spread out a bit?
Yeah.
I'm in Manchester now, yeah.
It's like 5-10 minute cycle from each other.
Is that how you get around?
Yeah, man.
That's great. So I was fortunate enough to see the film, which was great. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Where was it shot?
It was shot in Manchester as well, at the warehouse in Salford that we played at a couple of years ago for a festival called Sounds from the Other City.
Right.
Kind of like, multi-venue kind of crawl festival.
Yeah.
The Atom shots, like that's sort of the out in nature footage is in like Colne, I think, which is by Burnley,
yeah.
I believe.
Because that's awesome. That's beautiful. The footage at the start, it's like looks gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was the structure already there, or is that something you took to the site?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, they called called the Atom Panopticon, but what are all of them called? Are they all various like panopticons, like dotted out around different like nature like locations in the north of England, and we've been to a few of the structures.
Yeah.
Did lockdown force your hand into making a film, or do you think you would have got to this stage anyway?
Yeah, it's hard to know how soon or what point of our career it would have happened without lockdown, because I think it definitely was, you know, it did nudge us into the direction of making a film and kind of having a year to be able to spend on doing something like creatively different that wasn't related to like gigging and stuff, but we've always like been interested in doing films and stuff, so I think it would have come at another point if not this year.
Do you see like music and film and art as being intrinsically connected, or is it just where your own tastes are that you sort of are interested in, or do you think they are connected anyway?
Totally, man. They so connected, especially if like we all make art and films and stuff, and the more you think about composition of one form, the more you realise and see the similarities in the other forms. Like there's so many similarities between patterns of like repetition and variation and what makes a good piece of music/art or a film. They're all the disciplines are actually quite similar when you're composing it.
We started to think about it with writing the last album probably more than the first, where we were like writing music as though it was like narrative and kind of like tension and releases and stuff, and the way that the music flowed, and like, yeah, it was built around sort of like an idea of a narrative, less kind of lyrically, but more in the actual musicality of it. And then I think with the newer stuff we're writing at the moment for the future, it's kind of, again, thinking about writing music and lyrics in sort of like these different formal experimentations that are linked to film and like books and everything, like in different kind of ways, thinking about how we can imprint that onto our music.
Yeah. Do you think that you're particularly visual in the way you'll see music? Do you tend to have images in your head when you're playing?
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back to when we were like initially jamming together, we'd always jam along to projections of like our favourite films and stuff, and we'd kind of like improvise and write to those images. So I guess from doing that like super early on, it's kind of, we've taken that with us. And I don't know about you guys, but like particularly when I'm playing live, I'll quite often like just zone out into like a very like visual space that's not the space that I'm actually playing in. It's, yeah, like a film environment, yeah, or something, yeah, something there's quite psychedelic.
There's a bit of a detachment, isn't there?
Yeah.
Gets to, and the whole environment and lights and stuff become, they're not really what they are. It's, yeah, kind of weird. You do properly zone out, especially on songs that we've played for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can step back from.
You've got the muscle memory of being able to play it, so you're not consciously, yeah, thinking too much about playing it.
Yeah.
It's interesting, the idea of like the fact you're composing to projections anyway. You're almost kind of making imaginary scores, you know, yeah, to films. Are there particular films that you would go back to again and again? For what sort of stuff was you watching and playing to?
I think at the time, like the first one that we did was that really long car chase scene from Death Proof. Now we've kind of started in the studio that we're currently working in. Like the studio owner's got loads of old 16mm projections of like experimental short films, like Unchained Andalou.
Yeah.
By Louis Manuel. So I think we're going to start trying to like project those kind of things and get, yeah, a little bit more like weird with it.
Because the guy that we're doing the next album with is from an art school background. So anything curious like that, he actively promotes. And so he's got lots of short films from his days at Camberwell or wherever it was, I can't remember. But yeah, we're going to try and work them in to the room, as well as all of the modular synths and synthesizer. The live room is going to be cluttered.
Yeah.
It's fascinating that like visuals can influence sound, and then you start to think, oh yeah, what happens if I start playing along to like Yasujirō Ozu movies, or like, yeah. And I guess it's borne out by the fact that like different parts of a world have kind of distinct kind of flavors of regional music as well, yeah. And like that must come from, to a degree, the kind of visual environment.
Yeah,
yeah, totally. Definitely. You can see that.
Mm.
It makes you wonder what would happen if sort of you lived in like a sealed room all your life but had instruments. How limited, yeah, would you be in what you could create? It's interesting.
Yeah, really interesting.
Does the soundtrack, because I haven't heard the album's not out till Friday, is it? Is the album basically the audio of the, yeah, film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the audio came way before. That was like the first step. Where was it? Like June, July?
Yeah.
We went in and started thinking about the track list and also kind of how to make it seamless throughout and how we can blend songs in and where there is opportunities to make these atmospheric jam. We knew we were going to do two separate
atmospheric
sound scapes. Yeah.
I think because, yeah, there was like two moments in it all where we felt like it was like appropriate for like a bit of a release, to like segue you into the next sort,
yeah,
of.
They're great as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I think, as said, a key phrase earlier, which is peaks and troughs, which was kind of the running idea behind Discover Volador was these big moments of tension and release, and also with the soundtrack, they were there in the places where they were to let it breathe, and then the imagery on top, kind of, it all follows like a trip.
Yeah.
Did you re-record all the songs? Were you taking kind of elements and maybe adding things or recording extra bits? Were you taking some of the original sort of stems and running with that, or did you start from scratch?
We started from scratch. We kind of wanted it all to be live. Like, we liked the idea of, you know, bands in the 60s and 70s that would release albums that were like live from, and then the studio in which we recorded them from. So we kind of wanted to do that idea. Recorded it all live basically in kind of one take, and then wanted to almost emulate that with the video as well. So we've kind of made it look like it's filmed in one continuous take as well.
Is it wrong that I think this is better than Disco Volador?
No.
I think...
that's great.
Yeah, no, we're happy to hear that, to be honest, because I think there's always like an element to which like you somehow like rush to put some albums out, or like maybe we have in the past, and this to us kind of feels a bit like the natural development of these songs, how we would have played them live had we have been able to go on tour this year. And I think a song kind of comes to its fruition and like finds its life when it's live and you've played it so many more times. So I suppose the songs exist now as we probably intend them to exist more than they did in the first place.
Yeah. We had to naturally put in all of the jams that would have occurred just by gigging them so much, because we change things over time, so ever so slightly. But we had to do it in one fell swoop.
Mm-hmm.
As well, I think you come when you finish a record in this old way that we've been working, you do kind of have your thoughts and how you do it differently. And this was like a prime opportunity to see what could have happened if we'd had more time to actually do the songs and do them in a way where it was just our three input into it.
I suppose with like the ambient like songs and sections as well, it's like stuff we've always wanted to do, but kind of with pressures of being like the kind of band we are, sometimes it's kind of like you need to produce 10 to 12 pop singles or whatever to put out in a record. And yeah, the ambient thing was like an experiment for us at the time to see like, oh look, we can do this as well. And now for the future, we're hoping it's something we can incorporate a lot more.
Yeah, I know it's like a taste thing, but I grew up and still like a lot of prog stuff. So I grew up with Genesis and, you know, Floyd and Yes and whatever. So that's not, so this kind of feels, I know you wouldn't view it as proggy, but it has, it's more related to that world than Disco Volador is. So for me, it's like, oh, this is great. It's like conceptual and expansive. And I kind of liked Disco Volador on paper. I would sort of read about it and go, that sounds like a fascinating record. But I wasn't clicking with it. And then now it's sort of blended together with the sort of the ambient bits, and it's like a continuous thing. I'm like, and it's got the sort of longer jammy moments as well. I'm sort of really, I'm like really on board now.
You say that, because we're constantly just pushed to radio edit everything down as well. So I think if it was our choice, like every song would be these mad, like proggy versions.
When naturally, since we started, you know, putting out albums, in between the albums, with obviously thinking about the next one, and the little bits of music we record in between are us experimenting with what we eventually want to use on the next one. And this record was so great for seeing like the ways that we're going to be working in the future and what we want to achieve. And this is like a sketchbook for the next one.
There's no reason why you can't then edit things down to a radio edit. Like you can do what you want on the album. I mean, that's what a prog band's did, isn't it? You know, that you'd get these ridiculous sort of radio edits of lengthy songs or whatever. But like, you can still have singles whilst the albums are kind of more thematically linked or whatever. Were you thinking a lot about soundtracks and like the idea of making there's lots of ways to approach a soundtrack, isn't there? There's lots of types of soundtracks. Is there something? What were the sort of good things about soundtracks that you wanted this to feel like? Were there sort of touchstone soundtracks you were thinking of?
I think there's an interesting one that I've been listening to a lot recently, which is Miles Davis's soundtrack for a film called Elevated to the Gallows, and he did that as sort of like an improvisational thing whilst watching the projections of the film. Huh. So it was already completed and then he soundtracked kind of after, and I think that approach linked quite a lot to our idea with the film initially being quite sort of interdisciplinary, but also like linking to those like more felt emotions and stuff. And I think by literally layering the film onto like the musician and like the performance aspect of it, it kind of connects like the music and the film in a bit of a deeper way. I think we were thinking about it quite a lot in that way. So that's definitely one of the soundtracks that I'd say kind of has the same purpose as this one.
Huh. How about you, Sid? Was there anything that you had in mind soundtrack-wise that...
Yeah, I guess listening to a lot of like Joe Hisashi's stuff that he does for like anime films, but also like he does a lot of soundtrack for Kitano films as well, and like works quite heavily with like the idea of like motifs and stuff, which I guess we did not as much with the music, but we tried to add a lot of like visual motifs in the film. Like repetition, like the stuff with the projections and kind of zooming out the podium there. Yeah, like really good composer that we were inspired by.
Esme, I was going to ask about your bass playing and how it kind of feels almost like the lead instrument quite often. Like, and I wondered how much of that was like a conscious decision or whether it happened organically or whether there were other players or bands that you sort of heard that element in, or whether you felt there was kind of a gap that the bands weren't putting the bass up front more.
Yeah, I think it's mad. Like, I have kind of felt like I've changed my approach to playing bass through lockdown, really. Like, just went a good few months at the start of lockdown, like, not picking up an instrument at all. And then when I did, I must have listened to so many different things throughout that gap that suddenly, like, changed my whole approach to it. And in particular, I think there's a band called Two Rococo Raw that I think they just play with like sort of synths, drums, and then bass is the lead instrument in that. And I guess it's like, yeah, it sounds kind of texturally different, which is something I'm trying to like lock into a little bit more now. And yeah, it has got more of sort of like a guitar-y kind of quality, but more atmospheric sounding. Yeah.
Henry, is there ever any sort of, yeah, kind of creative, because guitarists often want to make a racket. Right? I know I do. Is there a bit of to and fro over either the mix or where the sonics are coming from? Are there times when you want to be a bit more expansive with sort of wigging out, basically?
I'm always very aware of the cliche about guitarists.
Yeah.
And sometimes I succumb to it and other times I try not to stand so in the front. I think with Disco Volador, me and Al, we're both in that mentality and we were always kind of competing for this mid-sonic space.
Yeah.
And when we came to do the soundtrack, I was kind of free in a sense because it was just moi. So yeah, I got to wig out a bit, but there were bits where I was definitely wanted to sit in the back and do something more textural with the guitar on, like, is it Space Slumber, like really Brian Eno sounding one, because I was thinking of my answer to that question you said earlier. I'm going to say it anyway. When at the beginning of the studio time for Disco Volador, Sid sent me a video of Brian Eno talking about Apollo.
Oh yeah.
And how, and the inspiration behind it. And that I listened to that to go to sleep to every night while we were there, because it's just such a good thing to soundtrack your dreams. I ended up having some really cool space related dreams, didn't I? But then listening to the how these guitar on that is kind of country inspired, and mm-hmm. all these like got this cool pedal that does like tape delays and, yeah. and things like that, simulations of them. So I wanted to, you know, there's more ways to, especially with this atmospheric stuff, I wanted to sit back and do something more textural with it.
Well, I think you're admirably restrained. This is kind of a meta question, like, but I wondered what it's like for you doing interviews, because it's like, just because you make music, you then have this weird kind of job part you have to do as well, where you have to promote it, and that, like, doesn't, just because you make music doesn't naturally mean that, you know, you're articulate about explaining how it was made, or that you want to share like your opinions about stuff. Or has that been like a difficult learning curve, or have you just been able to maintain like a relaxed kind of approach to it? I guess I'm asking if this is stressful for you.
I don't know. I think because we've been doing it, I guess, now for so long, it's kind of become less stressful, definitely. But there are kind of good and bad interviews, and it's nice to have ones that are kind of more conversational, and where we are able to just like explore and talk about our interests more than, you know, following like a kind of A-B structure of a typical interview that kind of would put us on like a pedestal of being band and interviewer, like, yeah. kind of appreciate ones more that are a little bit more like conversational, yeah. and we're able to open up and like just chat and explore topics that we wouldn't otherwise, I guess.
Yeah, we always when we finish interviews, we always know the good ones. I'll be like, oh yeah, that was actually really good, because when they come across conversational, and we get, because we always love the opportunity to explain more about why we did stuff in a certain way. I think it's good to be able to spout off your influence and your intentions behind it. So
I think it like weirdly tightens up ideas for the future sometimes as well. Like, it can be good when we get in a mindset where we're all literally just discussing things, and then it's kind of like, yeah, it helps you to move towards like where you see yourself in the future with it a little bit.
That definitely happened on especially during this lockdown. We'll be talking about summit, or like one of you two will say something and be like, that's totally where we're going. but you don't realise it until you open your mouth.
Yeah.
And then you just hear your stream of thought and you're like, oh yeah, that's it.
And I guess for you guys, the sort of intellectual side of the art is quite a big deal, because you see yourself as being multidisciplinary. You don't just want to do one thing. So it's kind of contextualizing that in some way, I guess, is helpful for... Yeah.
Super important, man. Context is everything with art. Therefore...
Yeah, I mean, it's the songs have got to be good as well, but...
Oh, totally, man. Yeah.
Have you ever worked out why you make music? I know it's a stupid question, but like, it's weird, because we're not born writing songs, and it's not something that everyone feels they have to do.
Still puzzles me to this day. No, I don't know. I do feel like it's probably different for Henry, because he started playing music even earlier than us.
Yeah.
But for me, said it is weird, because we started playing music once we'd created this friendship with Henry, and it's like a weird energy that all brought us together and all like told us to make music. So I don't really know when we were that young. We were like literally 10 years old, why we decided to meet up the next day and like pick up instruments and just start a band on the spot. Like, I can't remember having that conversation, but
it's you can't really remember the intentions behind starting the band at all. But I got asked this question quite recently, like, why do you love music? And no one had ever asked that question before. And I struggled for like 5 minutes trying to come up with the answer to that. But it's kind of, there's a very core need to make sound and express yourself, kind of like, I don't know, kind of like crying a bit.
Yeah, I guess it's almost like the least profound thing to talk about in a way, because it's just so like instinctual.
Yeah. Mm. It does just happen now. And if it doesn't happen for a long time, you get a bit itchy.
Yeah.
So it's something psychological, I guess, but
yeah, definitely. I guess that's why we've kind of like progressed into like wanting to make films and stuff too, because obviously if we were locked down when we couldn't, we were unable to play gigs and stuff. It was like, yeah, as Henry said, we got itchy feet and wanted to create anything, I guess, just together. So like,
yeah, true.
Yeah, this is our kind of like way of, this is our gig, I guess. This is our 2020 gig. Yeah.
It's interesting because I guess it's kind of like when you think about differences between like music and poetry, and like if someone's like a poet and they've got to create everything on the page.
Mm.
And so then the next stage is like if you're making an album, like the music can do so much of the heavy, like emotional heavy lifting and like can evoke stuff before you've said a word. But yeah. Then you've gone like a step further and layered visuals on top of that as well.
Dimensional.
Yeah. Is there a feeling that you want people to have when they watch the film or listen to a soundtrack? Can you like articulate the feeling you want people to have?
I guess it's more feeling in itself. Like it's not that we've been thinking about we want people to feel sad or happy or whatever about this. Like it's more that we want them to like have some feeling and like have a physical connection, kind of want to touch the screen and feel its textures in both the music and the visual elements of it. Like,
yeah,
it's more about, yeah, wanting to evoke in people sort of like a embodied guttural response to it, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all have said, like, it was so interesting when we were setting up the space itself and, like, letting our friends who were the extras in the film kind of walk in while we were setting up and getting ready for the shoot, and like straight away the moment they saw projections playing, their instinct was to walk around as though they were in this exhibition and just straight away get involved with it, I guess. And that was like perfect, and that's hopefully how people will feel whilst watching it as well. Like, yeah, as I said, they want to kind of embody this film to its full extent, I guess.
Are you sort of holding it back until it can be sort of screened? You're not just planning to dump it on YouTube, I gather.
Yeah, I think we're at the moment we're like discussing some places like physical screenings around the UK, kind of like unconventional spaces as well as like cinemas and venues, but
yeah,
kind of trying to replicate this idea of like happenings and sort of like experimental art pop-ups that
planetariums.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just like the feeling that it's quite exclusive and people go to it once and it won't really be the same if they went to it again in a different venue. Like,
yeah,
trying to get that kind of feeling.
In a sense, like there was a freedom that came with once the set was up. And there was like, there was relief from us that it was finished. But as people moved around and as we moved around, there was this sense of like true escapism in the set. Oh, that's better.
I felt sorry for you. Like I could see how much of sun was in your face.
Oh, I couldn't see again. And I suppose it's kind of, it's not completely lost, but it is a little bit through the screen. And I suppose when lockdown ends and stuff, and we can do this in a 3D space and under the cover of darkness and you're fully immersed in this thing, it'll be like, it's literally like nothing ever happened.
Mm.
It did feel that way when we were filming it. It was like lockdown what?
Yeah.
It was really nice. So we want to kind of, I suppose, do that again with the happenings.
Do you want to play live to the film as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the, it'll be slightly adapted, won't it?
For, yeah, probably.
When we do the live.
That's
soundtracking.
Another idea for it really is that it is just so ever, it's got the potential to be so ever evolving that like, yeah, the music could change slightly or even the visuals could be rearranged and you might not see the full film, but you might see separate visuals in different ways and stuff. And I think yeah, there's definitely scope for it to be like a unique performance at each kind of venue.
Because you've got the sort of meta idea of like, yeah, you see the film, but the band are on the screen, but the band also there in the room playing it, or you've got the option of kind of recreating the film in that the visuals are on the screens in the room with you playing. So it's almost like you're experiencing the film, like being in it instead of like an immersive cinema kind of thing. Yeah, it's got a lot of potential, isn't it?
When we did the film as well, there's so many moments within it that we kind of intentionally left in sections that showed us like making bits of the film, or even some of the like behind the scenes photographs that appear in it. So again, it'll be like this extra layer where like the film is being made and then being played and then being shown.
That's so perfect, because that's the whole time aspect of the film, isn't it?
Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, okay, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are their own. Thanks also this week to Damien Morgan and Shannon at Mango Management. I'll be back in 2 weeks.